"If in doubt, wait in the hall," whispered Michael as she left. He smiled, the professional veneer briefly gone. "When I started, I never knew where to find them. Our job is to pop up when they think they need us. But not, you know, to stalk them all the way to the bathroom." He was probably not much older than I was, but he looked like one of those people who came out of the womb handsome, color-coordinated and with perfectly polished shoes. I wondered if everyone in New York but me was like this. "How long have you worked here?"
"Just over a year. They had to let go their old social secretary because..."
He paused, seeming briefly uncomfortable.
"Well, fresh start and all that. And then after a while, they decided it didn't work having one assistant for two of them. That's where you come in. So, hello."
He held out his hand. I shook it.
"You like it here?" "I love it. I never know who I'm more in love with, him or her." He grinned. "He's just the smartest and so handsome. And she's a doll."
"Do you run with them?"
"Run? Are you kidding me?" He shuddered. "I don't do sweating. Apart from with Nathan. Oh, my. I would sweat with him. Isn't he gorgeous?" He offered to do my shoulder, and I fell instantly in love.
"How on earth have you managed to work with him this long without jumping those delicious Antipodean bones?"
"I... don't tell me. If you've been there, I don't want to know. We have to stay friends." "Right, I need to get down to Wall Street."
He gave me a credit card. For emergencies, she forgets hers all the time. All statements go straight to him. And an electronic tablet. Then showed me how to set up the PIN code.
"All the contact numbers you need are here, and everything to do with the calendar is on here," he said, scrolling down the screen with a forefinger. "Each person is color-coded. You'll see Mr. Gopnik is blue, Mrs. Gopnik is red, and Tabitha is yellow. We don't run her diary anymore as she lives away from home, but it's useful to know when she's likely to be here, and whether there are joint family commitments, like meetings at the trusts or the foundation. I've set you up a private email, and if there are changes, you and I will communicate them with each other to back up any changes made on the screen. You have to double-check everything. Schedule clashes are the only thing guaranteed to make him mad."
"Okay.
So, you'll go through her post every morning, work out what she wants to attend. I'll cross-check with you, as sometimes there are things she says no to and he overrides her. So don't throw anything away. Just keep two piles."
"How many invites are there?"
"Oh, you have no idea. The Gopniks are basically top tier. That means they get invited to everything and go to almost none of it. Second tier, you wish you were invited to half and go to everything you're invited to.
Third tier?
Crashers would go to the opening of a burrito truck. You get them even at society events."
He sighed. "Oh, so embarrassing." I scanned the diary page, zooming in on this week, which to me appeared to be a terrifying rainbow mess of colors. I tried not to look as daunted as I felt.
"What's brown?" "That's Felix's appointments. The cat."
"The cat has his own social diary."
"It's just groomers, veterinary appointments, dental hygienists, that sort of thing."
"Oh, no. He's got the behaviorist in this week. He must have been pooping in the Ziegler again."
"And purple?"
Michael lowered his voice. "The former Mrs. Gopnik. If you see a purple block next to an event, that's because she will also be present." He was about to say something else, but his phone rang.
"Yes, Mr. Gopnik? Yes, of course. Yes, I will. Be right there."
He put his phone back in his bag.
"Okay, gotta go. Welcome to the team."
"How many of us are there?" I said. But he was already running out of the door, his coat over his arm.
"First big purple is in 2 weeks' time, okay? I'll email you. And wear normal clothes when you're outside, or you'll look like you work for Whole Foods."
The day passed in a blur. 20 minutes later, we walked out of the building and into a waiting car that took us to a glossy salon a few blocks away. Me trying desperately to look like the kind of person who spent a whole life getting in and out of large black cars with cream leather interiors. I sat at the edge of the room while Agnes had her hair washed and styled by a woman whose own hair appeared to have been cut with the aid of a ruler, and an hour later, the car took us to the dental appointment, where, again, I sat in the waiting room. Everywhere we went was hushed and tasteful, and a world away from the madness on the street below. I had worn one of my more sober outfits. A navy blouse with anchors on it and a striped pencil skirt, and I needn't have worried. At each place I became instantly invisible. It was as if I had staff tattooed on my forehead. I started to notice the other personal assistants, pacing outside on cell phones, or racing back in with dry cleaning and speciality coffees in cardboard holders. I wondered if I should be offering Agnes coffee, or officiously ticking things off lists. Most of the time, I wasn't entirely sure why I was there. The whole thing seemed to run like clockwork without me. It was as if I was simply human armour, a portable barrier between Agnes and the rest of the world. Agnes, meanwhile, was distracted, talking in Polish on her cell phone, or asking me to make notes on my tablet. "We need to check with Michael that Leonard's grey suit was cleaned. And maybe call Mrs. Levetsky about my Givenchy dress. I think I have lost a little weight since I last wear it. She maybe can take it in an inch." She peered into her oversized Prada handbag, pulling out a plastic strip of pills from which she popped two into her mouth. "Water?" I cast around, finding one in the door pocket. I unscrewed it and handed it to her. The car stopped. "Thank you." The driver, a middle-aged man with thick dark hair and jowls that wobbled as he moved, stepped out to open her door. When she disappeared into the restaurant, the doorman welcoming her like an old friend, I made to climb out behind her, but the driver shut the door. I was left on the back seat. I sat there for a minute, wondering what I was meant to do. I checked my phone. I peered through the window, wondering if there were sandwich shops nearby. I tapped my foot. Finally, I leant forward through the front seats. My dad used to leave me and my sister in the car when he went to the pub. He'd bring us out a Coke and a packet of pickled onion Monster Munch, and that would be us sorted for 3 hours. I tapped my knee with my fingers. He'd probably be done for child abuse now. Mind you, pickled onion Monster Munch was our absolute favourite. Best part of the week. The driver said nothing. I leant forward a bit further so that my face was inches from his. "So, how long does this usually take?"
"As long as it takes."
His eyes slid away from mine in the mirror. "And you wait here the whole time?"
"That's my job."
I sat for a moment, then put my hand through to the front seat. "I'm Louisa, Mrs. Gopnik's new assistant."
"Nice to meet you."
He didn't turn around. Those were the last words he said to me. He slid a CD into the music system. "Estoy perdido," said a Spanish woman's voice. "¿Dónde está el baño?"
"Estoy perdido donde está el baño,"
the driver repeated. "¿Cuán tu cuesta?"
"¿Cuán tu cuesta?"
came his reply. I spent the next hour sitting in the back of the car, staring at the iPad, trying not to listen to the driver's linguistic exercises, and wondering if I should also be doing something useful. I emailed Michael to ask, but he simply responded, "That's your lunch break, sweetie. Enjoy. Kiss, kiss." I didn't like to tell him I had no food. In the warmth of the waiting car, tiredness began to creep over me again, like a tide. I laid my head against the window, telling myself it was normal to feel disjointed, out of my depth. "You're going to feel uncomfortable in your new world for a bit. It always does feel strange to be knocked out of your comfort zone." Will's last letter echoed through me as if from a long distance. And then nothing. I woke with a start as the door opened. Agnes was climbing in, her face white, her jaw set. "Everything okay?" I said, scrambling upright, but she didn't answer. We drove off in silence, the still air of the interior suddenly heavy with tension. She turned to me. I scrambled for a bottle of water and held it up to her. "Do you have cigarettes?"
No.
"Gary, do you have cigarettes?"
"No, ma'am, but we can get you some."
Her hand was shaking. I noticed now. She reached into her bag, pulling out a small bottle of pills, and I handed over the water. She swigged some down, and I noticed tears in her eyes. We pulled up outside a Duane Reade, and after a moment I realized I was expected to get out.
"What kind? I mean, what brand?"
"Marlboro Lights," she said, and dabbed her eyes. I jumped out, well, more of a hobble, really, as my legs were seizing up from the morning's run, and bought a packet, thinking how odd it was to buy cigarettes from a pharmacy. When I got back into the car, she was shouting at somebody in Polish on her cell phone. She ended the call, then opened the window and lit a cigarette, inhaling deeply. She offered one to me. I shook my head. "Don't tell Leonard," she said, and her face softened. "He hates me smoking." We sat there for a few minutes, the engine running, while she smoked the cigarette in short, angry bursts that made me fear for her lungs. Then she stubbed out the last inch, her lips curling over some internal fury, and waved for Gary to drive on. I was left briefly to my own devices while Agnes had her piano lesson. I retreated to my room, where I thought about lying down, but was afraid that my stiff legs would mean I couldn't get up again. So instead, I sat at the little desk, wrote Sam a quick letter, and checked the calendar for the next few days. As I did so, music began to echo through the apartment. First scales, then something melodic and beautiful. I stopped to listen, marvelling at the sound, wondering how it must feel to be able to create something so gorgeous. I closed my eyes, letting it flow through me, remembering the evening when Will had taken me to my first concert and begun to force the world open for me. Live music was so much more three-dimensional than recorded. It short-circuited something deep within. Agnes's playing seemed to come from some part of her that remained closed, and in her dealings with the world. Something vulnerable and sweet and lovely. He would have enjoyed this, I thought absently. He would have loved being here. At the exact point it swelled into something truly magical, Ilaria started up the vacuum cleaner, swamping the sound with a roar, the unforgiving bump of machinery into heavy furniture. The music stopped. My phone buzzed. "Please tell her to stop the vacuum." I climbed off my bed and walked through the apartment until I found Ilaria, who was pushing the vacuum cleaner furiously just outside Agnes's study door. Her head dipped as she wrenched it backwards and forwards. I swallowed. There was something about Ilaria that made you hesitate before confronting her, even though she was one of the few people in the zip code shorter than I was. "Ilaria," I said. She didn't stop. "Ilaria!" I stood in front of her until she was forced to notice. She kicked the off button with her heel and glared at me. "Mrs. Gopnik has asked if you would mind doing the vacuuming some other time. She can't hear her music lesson." "When does she think I am meant to clean the apartment?" Ilaria spat, loud enough to be heard through the door.
Maybe at any other part during the day, apart from this particular 40 minutes.
She pulled the plug from the socket and dragged the cleaner noisily across the room. She glared at me with such venom that I almost stepped backwards. There was a brief silence, and the music started up again. When Agnes finally emerged 20 minutes later, she looked sideways at me and smiled. That first week moved in fits and starts, like the first day with me watching Agnes for signals in the way that Mum used to watch our old dog when her bladder got leaky. Does she need to go out? What does she want? Where should I be? I jogged with Agnes and George every morning, waving them on from about a mile in and motioning towards my hip before walking slowly back to the building. I spent a lot of time sitting in the hall, studying my iPad intently when anybody walked past, so that I might look as if I knew what I was doing. Michael came every day and briefed me in whispered bursts. He seemed to spend his life on the run between the apartment and Mr. Gopnik's Wall Street office, one of two cell phones pressed to his ear, dry-cleaning over his arm, coffee in his hand. He was completely charming and always smiling, and I had absolutely no idea if he liked me at all. I barely saw Nathan. He seemed to be employed to fit around Mr. Gopnik's schedule. Sometimes he would work with him at 5 a.m. At others it was 7 o'clock in the evening, disappearing to the office to help him there if necessary.
"I'm not employed for what I do," Nathan explained. "I'm employed for what I can do."
Occasionally he would vanish, and I would discover that he and Mr. Gopnik had jetted somewhere overnight. It could be San Francisco or Chicago. Mr. Gopnik had a form of arthritis that he worked hard to keep under control, so he and Nathan would swim or work out, often several times each day, to supplement his regime of anti-inflammatories and painkillers. Alongside Nathan and George the trainer, who also came every weekday morning, The other people who passed through the apartment that first week were the cleaners. Apparently, there was a distinction between what Ilaria did, housekeeping, and actual cleaning. Twice a week, a team of three liveried women and one man blitzed their way through the apartment. They did not speak, except to consult briefly with each other. Each carried a large crate of eco-friendly cleaning materials, and they were gone 3 hours later, leaving Ilaria to sniff the air and run her fingers along the skirting disapprovingly. The florist, who arrived in a van on Monday morning and brought enormous vases of arranged blooms to be placed at strategic intervals in the communal areas of the apartment. Several of the vases were so large that it took two to carry them in. They removed their shoes at the door. The gardener. Yes, really. This at first made me slightly hysterical. You do realise we're on the second floor. Until I discovered that the long balconies at the back of the building were lined with pots of miniature trees and blossoms, which the gardener would water, trim, and feed before disappearing again. It did make the balcony look beautiful, but nobody ever went out there, except me. The pet behaviourist. A tiny bird-like Japanese woman appeared at 10 a.m. on a Friday, watched Felix at a distance for an hour or so, then examined his food, his litter tray, the places he slept, quizzed Ilaria on his behaviour, and advised on what toys he needed or whether his scratching post was sufficiently tall and stable. Felix ignored her for the entire time she was there, breaking off only to wash his bottom with what seemed like almost insulting enthusiasm. The grocery team came twice a week and brought with them large green crates of fresh food, which they unpacked under Ilaria's supervision. I caught sight of the bill one day. It would have fed my family and possibly half my postcode for several months. And that was without the manicurist, the dermatologist, the piano teacher, the man who serviced and cleaned the cars, the handyman who worked for the building and sorted out replacement light bulbs or faulty air conditioning. There was the stick-thin red-headed woman who brought large shopping bags from Bergdorf Goodman or Saks Fifth Avenue and viewed everything Agnes tried on with a gimlet eye, stating,
"No, no, no. Oh, that's perfect, honey. That's lovely. You want to wear that with the little Prada bag I showed you last week. Now, what are we doing about the gala?"
There was the wine merchant and the man who hung the pictures and the woman who cleaned the curtains and the man who buffed the parquet floors in the main living room with a thing that looked like a lawnmower, and a few others besides. I simply got used to seeing people I didn't recognise wandering around. I'm not sure there was a single day in the first 2 weeks when there were fewer than five people in the apartment at any one time. It was a family home in name only. It felt like a workspace for me, Nathan, Ilaria, and an endless team of contractors, staff, and hangers-on who traipsed through it from dawn until late into the evening. Sometimes after supper, a procession of Mr. Gopnik's suited colleagues would stop by, disappear into his study and emerge an hour later, muttering about calls to D.C. or Tokyo. He never really seemed to stop working, other than the time he spent with Nathan. Even at dinner, his two phones were on the mahogany table, buzzing discreetly like trapped wasps as messages filed in. I found myself watching Agnes, sometimes as she closed the door to her dressing room in the middle of the day, presumably the only space she could disappear. And I would wonder, when was this place ever just a home? This, I concluded, was why they disappeared at weekends, unless the country residents had staff too.
"Nah, that's the one place she's managed to sort her way," said Nathan when I asked him. "She told him to give the ex their weekend place. In return, she got him to downscale to a modest place on the beach. 3 beds, 1 bathroom. No staff." He shook his head. "And therefore, no tab. She's not stupid."
"Hey, you." Sam was in uniform. I did some mental calculations and worked out he had just finished his shift. He ran his hand through his hair, then leant forward as if to see me better through the pixelated screen. A little voice said in my head, as it did every time I'd spoken to him since I'd left, "What are you doing moving to a different continent from this man?" "You went in then?"
"Yeah," he sighed.
"Not the best first day back."
"Why?"
"Donna quit." I couldn't hide my shock. Donna, straight-talking, funny, calm, was the yin to his yang, his anchor, his voice of sanity at work. It was impossible trying to imagine one without the other.
"What? Why?" Her dad got cancer. Aggressive. Incurable. She wants to be there for him.
Oh, God. Poor Donna. Poor Donna's dad.
Yeah, it's rough. And now I have to wait and see who they're going to pair me with. I don't think they'll put me with a rookie because of the whole disciplinary issues thing. So I'm guessing it'll be someone from another district.
Sam had been up in front of the disciplinary committee twice since we had been together. I had been responsible for at least one of those and felt the reflexive twinge of guilt.
You'll miss her.
Yep.
He looked a bit battered. I wanted to reach through the screen and hug him.
She saved me, he said.
He wasn't prone to dramatic statements, which somehow made those three words more poignant. I still remembered that night in bursts of terrifying clarity. Sam's gunshot wound bleeding out over the floor of the ambulance. Donna calm, capable, barking instructions at me, keeping that fragile thread unbroken until the other medics finally arrived. I could still taste fear, visceral and metallic in my mouth. Could still feel the obscene warmth of Sam's blood on my hands. I shivered, pushing the image aside. I didn't want Sam in the protection of anyone else. He and Donna were a team, two people who would never let each other down, and would probably rib each other mercilessly afterwards.
When does she leave?
Next week. She's got special dispensation, given her family circumstances. He sighed. Still, on the bright side, your mum's invited me to lunch on Sunday. Apparently we're having roast beef and all the trimmings. Oh, and your sister asked me round to the flat. Don't look like that. She asked if I could help her bleed your radiators.
That's it now, you're in. My family have you like a Venus flytrap.
It'll be strange without you. Maybe I should just come home. He tried to raise a smile and failed.
What?
Nothing.
Go on.
I don't know. Feels like I just lost my two favourite women.
A lump rose to my throat. The spectre of the third woman he'd lost, his sister, who had died of cancer 2 years previously, hung between us.
Sam, you didn't lo-
Ignore that. Unfair of me.
I'm still yours. Just at a distance for a while.
He blew out his cheeks.
I didn't expect to feel it this badly.
I don't know whether to be pleased or sad now.
I'll be fine. It's just one of those days.
I sat there for a moment watching him.
Okay, so here's the plan. First, you go and feed your hens, because you always find watching them soothing. And nature is good for perspective and all that.
He straightened up a little.
Then what?
You make yourself one of those really great bolognese sauces, the ones that take forever with the wine and bacon and stuff, because it's almost impossible to feel crap after eating a really great spaghetti bolognese.
Hens, sauce.
Okay. And then you switch on the television and find a really good film, something you can get lost in, no reality TV, nothing with ads.
Louisa Clark's Evening Remedies. I'm liking this.
And then, I thought for a moment,
you think about the fact that it's only a little over 3 weeks until we see each other. And that means this.
Ta-da!
I pulled my top up to my neck. With hindsight, it was a pity that Ilaria chose that exact moment to open my door and walk in with the laundry. She stood there, a pile of towels under one arm, and froze as she took in my exposed bosom, the man's face on the screen. Then she closed the door quickly, muttering something under her breath. I scrambled to cover myself up.
What? Sam was grinning, trying to peer to the right of the screen. What's going on?
The housekeeper, I said, straightening my top. Oh, God!
Sam had fallen back in his chair. He was properly laughing now, one hand clutching his stomach, where he still got a little protective about his scar.
You don't understand. She hates me.
And now you're Madame Webcam.
He was still laughing. My name will be mud in the housekeeping community from here to Palm Springs. I wailed a bit longer, then started to giggle. Seeing Sam laugh so much, it was hard not to. He grinned at me.
Well, Lou, you did it. You cheered me up.
The downside for you is that's the first and last time I show you my lady bits over Wi-Fi.
Sam leant forward and blew me a kiss.
"Yeah, well," he said. "I guess we should just be grateful it wasn't the other way around."
Ilaria didn't talk to me for 2 whole days after the webcam incident. She would turn away when I walked into a room, immediately finding something with which to busy herself, as if by merely catching her eye, I might somehow contaminate her with my penchant for salacious boob exposure. Nathan asked what had gone down between us after she pushed my coffee towards me with an actual spatula, but I couldn't explain it without it sounding somehow worse than it was. So I muttered something about laundry and why we should have locks on our doors, and hoped that he would let it go.
Chapter 4. From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com to catclark1@yahoo.com.
Hey, stinky-ass bandit yourself. Is that how a respected accountant is really meant to talk to her globetrotting sister?
I'm good, thanks. My employer, Agnes, is my age and really nice, so that's been a bonus. You wouldn't believe the places I'm going. Last night I went to a ball in a dress that cost more than I earn in a month. Oh, I felt like Cinderella.
Except with a really gorgeous sister. Yep, so that's a new one for me. Ha ha ha.
Glad Tom is enjoying his new school. Don't worry about the felt tip thing, we can always paint that wall. Mum says it's a sign of his creative expression.
Did you know she's trying to get Dad to go to night school to learn to express himself better? He's got it into his head. This means she's going to get him going tantric.
God knows where he's read about that.
I pretended like she told me that was definitely it when he called me. And now I'm feeling a bit guilty because he's panicking that he'll have to get his old fella out in front of a room full of strangers. Write me more news, especially about the date. Miss you, Lou. Kiss, kiss, kiss. P.S. If Dad does get his old fella out in front of a room full of strangers, I don't want to know anything.
According to Agnes's social diary, numerous events were highlights of the New York social calendar. But the Neil and Florence Strager Charitable Foundation dinner teetered somewhere near the pinnacle. Guests wore yellow, the men in necktie form, unless particularly exhibitionist, and the resulting photographs were distributed in publications from the New York Post to Harper's Bazaar. Dress was formal, the yellow outfits were dazzling, and tickets cost a pocketful of small change under $30,000 a table. For the outer reaches of the room. I knew this because I had started researching each event that Agnes was due to attend, and that this was a big one, not just because of the amount of preparation, manicurist, hairdresser, masseur, extra George in the mornings, but because of Agnes's stress level. She physically vibrated through the day, shouting at George that she couldn't do the exercises he'd given her, couldn't run the distance. It was all impossible. George, who possessed an almost Buddha-like level of calm, said that that was totally fine. They would walk back and the endorphins from the walk were all good. When he left, he gave me a wink, as if this were entirely to be expected. Mr. Gopnik, perhaps in response to some distress call, came home at lunchtime and found her locked into her dressing room. I collected some dry cleaning from a shook and cancelled her teeth whitening appointment, then sat in the hall, unsure what I should be doing. I heard her muffled voice as he opened the door. "I don't want to go." Whatever she went on to say kept Mr. Gopnik at home way after I might have expected. Nathan was out, so I couldn't talk to him. Michael stopped by, peering around the door. "Is he still here?" he said. "My tracker stopped working."
"Tracker?" "On his phone. Only way I can work out where he is half the time."
"He's in her dressing room." I didn't know what else to say. How far to trust Michael. But it was hard to ignore the sound of raised voices. "I don't think Mrs. Gopnik is very keen on going out tonight."
"Big purple. I told you."
And then I remembered. The former Mrs. Gopnik? This was her big night, and Agnes knows it. Still is. All her old harpies will be there. They're not the friendliest. Well, that explains a lot. He's a big benefactor, so he can't not show. Plus, he's old friends with the Stragers. But it's one of the tougher nights of their calendar. Last year was a total wipeout.
Why?
Aw, she walked in like a lamb to the slaughter. He pulled a face. Thought they would be her new best friends, from what I heard afterwards. They fried her. I shuddered. Can she not just leave him to go by himself?
Oh, honey, you have no idea how it works here. No, no, no. She has to go. She has to put a smile on her face and be seen in the pictures. That's her job now, and she knows it. But it's not going to be pretty.
The voices had risen. We heard Agnes protesting, then Mr. Gopnik's softer voice pleading, reasonable.
Michael looked at his watch. I'll head back to the office. Do me a favor, text me when he leaves.
I have 58 things for him to sign before 3 p.m.
Love ya!
He blew me a kiss and was gone. I sat for a while longer, trying not to listen to the argument down the corridor. I scrolled through the calendar, wondering if there was anything I could do to be useful. Felix strolled past, his lifted tail a question mark, supremely unbothered by the actions of the humans around him. And then the door opened. Mr. Gopnik saw me.
Ah, Louisa, can you come in for a moment?
I stood and half-walked, half-ran to where he was standing. It was difficult as running brought on muscle spasms.
I wondered if you were free this evening.
Free?
To come to an event for charity.
Sure. I had known from the start that the hours would not be regular, and at least it meant I wasn't likely to bump into Ilaria. I would download a movie onto one of the iPads and watch it in the car.
There. What do you think, darling?
Agnes looked as if she'd been crying.
She can sit next to me?
I'll sort it out. She took a deep, shaky breath.
Okay, then.
I suppose so.
Sit next to...
Good. Good. Mr. Gopnik checked his phone. Right, I really have to go. I'll see you in the main ballroom, 7:30. If I can get through this conference call any sooner, I'll let you know.
He stepped forward and took her face in his hands, kissing her.
You're okay?
I'm okay.
I love you. Very much. Another kiss and he was gone.
Agnes took another deep breath. She put her hands on her knees, then looked up at me.
You have a yellow ball gown?
I stared at her.
Nope. Bit short on ball gowns, actually.
She ran her gaze up and down me as if trying to work out whether I could fit into anything she owned. I think we both knew the answer to that one.
Then she straightened. Call Gary. We need to get to Saks.
Half an hour later, I was standing in a changing room while two shop assistants pushed my bosoms into a strapless dress, the colour of unsalted butter. The last time I had been handled this intimately, I quipped, I had discussed getting engaged immediately afterwards.
Nobody laughed.
Agnes frowned.
Too bridal, it makes her look thick around the waist.
That's because I am thick around the waist?
We do some very good corrective panties, Mrs. Gopnik.
Oh, I'm not sure I... Do you have anything more 50s style? Said Agnes, flicking through her phone.
Because this will pull in her waist and get around the height issue. We don't have time to take anything up.
When is your event, ma'am?
We have to be there at 7:30.
We can alter the dress for you in time, Mrs. Gopnik. I'll get Terry to deliver it over to you by 6.
Then let's try the sunflower yellow one. And that one, with the sequins.
If I'd known that the afternoon would be the one time in my life I would be trying on $3,000 dresses, I might have made sure I wasn't wearing comedy knickers with a sausage dog on them and a bra that was held together with a safety pin. I wondered how many times in one week you could end up exposing your breasts to perfect strangers. I wondered if they had seen a body like mine before, with actual fatty bits. The shop assistants were far too polite to comment on it, beyond repeatedly offering corrective underwear, but simply brought in dress after dress, wrestling me in and out like someone wrangling livestock, until Agnes, sitting on an upholstered chair, announced,
"Yes, this is the one."
"Oh, what do you think, Louisa? It is even perfect length for you with the twill underskirt." I stared at my reflection. I wasn't sure who was staring back at me. My waist was nipped in by an inbuilt corset, my bosom hoisted upwards into a perfect embonpoint. The colour made my skin glow, and the long skirt made me a foot taller and entirely unlike myself. The fact that I couldn't breathe was irrelevant.
"We will put your hair up and some earrings."
"Perfect."
"And this dress is 20% off," said one of the shop assistants.
"We don't sell much yellow after the Strager event each year." I almost deflated with relief. And then I gazed at the label. The sale price was $2,575. A month's wages. I think Agnes must have seen my bleached face, for she waved at one of the women. "Louisa, you get changed. Do you have any shoes that will go? We can run to the shoe department."
"I have shoes, lots of shoes."
I had some gold satin-heeled dancing pumps, which would look fine. I did not want this bill going any higher. I went back into the changing cubicle and climbed out of the dress carefully, feeling the weight of it fall expensively around me. And as I got dressed, I listened to Agnes and the assistants talking. Agnes summoned a bag and some earrings, gave them a cursory glance and was apparently satisfied.
"Charge it to my account."
"Certainly, Mrs. Gopnik." I met her at the cash desk. As we walked away, me clutching the bags, I said quietly,
"So do you want me to be extra careful?"
She looked at me blankly.
"With the dress?"
Still, she looked blank. I lowered my voice.
"At home, we tuck the label in and then you can take it back the next day. You know, as long as there are no accidental wine stains and it doesn't stink too much of cigarettes. Maybe give it a quick squirt of Febreze."
"Take it back?"
"To the shop."
"Why would we do this?" she said as we climbed back into the waiting car and Gary put the bags into the boot.
"Oh, don't look so anxious, Louisa. You think I don't know how you feel?"
"I have nothing when I come here. Me and my friends, we even shared our clothes. But you have to wear good dress when you sit next to me this evening. You can't wear your uniform. This evening you are not staff. And I am happy to pay for this."
"Okay.
You understand, yes? Tonight, you have to not be staff. It's very important." I thought of the enormous carrier bag in the boot behind me as the car navigated its way slowly through the Manhattan traffic, a little dumbstruck at the direction this day was taking.
"Leonard says you looked after a man who died."
"I did. His name was Will."
"He says you have discretion."
"I try."
"And also that you don't know anyone here."
"Just Nathan."
She thought about this.
"Nathan. I think he is a good man. He really is." She studied her nails.
"You speak Polish?"
"No," I added quickly. "But maybe I could learn if you..."
"You know what is difficult for me, Louisa."
I shook my head.
"I don't know who I..."
She hesitated, then apparently changed her mind about what she was going to say.
"I need you to be my friend tonight, okay? Leonard, he will have to do his work thing, always talking with the men, but you will stay with me, yes? Right by me. Whatever you want. And if anybody asks, you are my old friend, from when I lived in England. We knew each other from school, not my assistant, okay?"
"Got it. From school." That seemed to satisfy her. She nodded and settled back in her seat. She said nothing else the whole way back to the apartment. The New York Palace Hotel, which held the Strager Foundation Gala, was so grand it was almost comical. A fairy tale fortress with a courtyard and arched windows. It was dotted with liveried footmen in daffodil silk knickerbockers. It was as if they had looked at every grand hotel in Europe, taken notes about ornate cornicing, marble lobbies and fiddly bits of gilt, and decided to add it all together, sprinkle some Disney fairy dust on it, and ramp it up to camp levels all of its own. I half expected to see a pumpkin coach and the odd glass slipper on the red stair carpet. As we pulled up, I gazed into the glowing interior, the twinkling lights and sea of yellow dresses, and almost wanted to laugh, but Agnes was so tense I didn't dare. Plus, my bodice was so tight I would probably burst my seams. Gary dropped us outside the main entrance, levering the car into a turning area thick with huge black limousines. We walked in past a crowd of onlookers on the sidewalk. A man took our coats and for the first time, I saw what Agnes was wearing. She looked astonishing. Her dress was not a conventional ball gown, like mine, or like any of the other women's. But neon yellow, structured, a floor-length tube with one sculpted shoulder motif that rose up to her head. Her hair was scraped back unforgivingly tight and sleek, and two enormous gold and yellow diamond earrings hung from her ears. It should have looked extraordinary, but here, I realized with a faint drop to my stomach, it was somehow too much. out of place in the old-world grandeur of the hotel. As she stood there, nearby heads swiveled, eyebrows lifting as the matrons in their yellow silk wraps and boned corsets viewed her from the corners of carefully made-up eyes. Agnes appeared oblivious. She glanced around distractedly, trying to locate her husband. She wouldn't relax until she had hold of his arm. Sometimes I watched them together, and saw an almost palpable sense of relief come over her when she felt him beside her. "Your dress is amazing," I said. She looked down at me as if she had just remembered I was there. A flashbulb went off, and I saw that photographers were moving among us. I stepped away to give Agnes space, but the man motioned towards me.
"You too, ma'am. That's it. And smile."
She smiled, her gaze flickering towards me as if reassuring herself I was still nearby. And then Mr. Gopnik appeared. He walked over a little stiffly. Nathan had said he was having a bad week, and kissed his wife's cheek. I heard him murmur something into her ear, and she smiled, a sincere, unguarded smile. Their hands briefly clasped, and in that moment I noted that two people could fit all the stereotypes, and yet there was something about them that was completely genuine, a delight in each other's presence. It made me feel suddenly wistful for Sam. But then I couldn't imagine him somewhere like this, trussed up in a dinner jacket and bow tie. He would, I thought absently, have hated it.
"Name, please?"
The photographer appeared at my shoulder. Perhaps it was thinking of Sam that made me do it.
"Louisa Clark Fielding,"
I said in my most strangulated upper-class accent.
"From England."
"Mr. Gopnik, over here, Mr. Gopnik!"
I backed into the crowd as the photographers took pictures of them together, his hand resting lightly on his wife's back, her shoulders straight and chin up, as if she could command the gathering. And then I saw him scan the room for me, his eyes meeting mine across the lobby. He walked Agnes over. "Darling, I have to talk to some people. Will you two be all right going out on your own?" "Of course, Mr. Gopnik," I said, as if I did this kind of thing every day. "Will you be back soon?" Agnes still had hold of his hand. "I have to talk to Wainwright and Miller. I promised I'd give them 10 minutes to go over this bond deal." Agnes nodded, but her face betrayed her reluctance to let him go. As she walked through the lobby, Mr. Gopnik leant into me. "Don't let her drink too much. She's nervous." "Yes, Mr. Gopnik." He nodded, glanced around him as if deep in thought, then turned back to me and smiled. "You look very nice." And then he was gone. The ballroom was jammed, a sea of yellow and black. I wore the yellow and black beaded bracelet Will's daughter Lily had given me before I'd left England, and thought privately how much I would have loved to wear my bumblebee tights too. These women didn't look like they'd had fun with their wardrobes their entire lives. The first thing that struck me was how thin most of them were, hoiked into tiny dresses, clavicles poking out like safety rails. Women of a certain age in Stortfold tended to spread gently outwards, cloaking their extra inches in cardigans or long jumpers. "Does it cover my bum?" And paying lip service to looking good in the form of the occasional new mascara or a 6-weekly haircut. In my hometown, it was as if to pay too much attention to yourself was somehow suspect or suggested unhealthy self-interest. But the women in this ballroom looked as if they made their appearance a full-time job. There was no hair not perfectly coiffed into shape, no upper arm that was not toned into submission by some rigorous daily workout. Even the women of uncertain years, it was hard to tell given the amount of Botox and fillers, looked as if they'd never heard of a bingo wing, let alone flapped one. I thought of Agnes, her personal trainer, her dermatologist, her hairdressing and manicurist appointments, and thought, this is her job now. She has to do all that maintenance so she can turn up here and hold her own in this crowd. Agnes moved slowly among them, her head held high, smiling at her husband's friends, who came over to greet her and share a few words while I hovered uncomfortably in the background. The friends were always men. It was only men who smiled at her. The women, while not rude enough to walk away, tended to turn their faces discreetly, as if suddenly distracted by something in the distance, so that they didn't have to engage with her. Several times as we continued through the crowd, me walking behind her, I saw a wife's expression tighten, as if Agnes's presence was some kind of transgression.
"Good evening," said a voice at my ear. I looked up and stumbled backwards. Will Traynor stood beside me.
Chapter 5. Afterwards, I was glad that the room was so crowded, because when I stumbled sideways into the man next to me, he instinctively reached out a hand and, in an instant, several dinner-suited arms were righting me, a sea of faces smiling, concerned. As I thanked them, apologizing, I saw my mistake. No, not Will. His hair was the same cut and colour, his skin that same caramel hue. But I must have gasped aloud because the man who was not Will said,
"I'm sorry, did I startle you?"
No. I put my hand to my cheek, my eyes locked on his. You just look like someone I know, new. I felt my face flush, the kind of stain that starts at your chest and it floods its way up to your hairline.
"You okay?"
"Oh, gosh, fine, I'm fine." I felt stupid now, my face glowed with it.
"You're English." "You're not."
"Not even a New Yorker. Bostonian. Joshua William Ryan III. He held out his hand. "You even have his name."
"I'm sorry."
I took his hand. Close up, he was quite different from Will. His eyes were dark brown, his brow lower. But the similarities had left me completely unbalanced. I tore my gaze away from him, conscious that I was still hanging on to his fingers. "I'm sorry, I'm a little..."
"Let me get you a drink."
"I can't. I meant to be with my friend over there." He looked at Agnes.
"Then I'll get you both a drink. It'll be, easy to find you."
He grinned and touched my elbow. I tried not to stare at him as he walked off. As I approached Agnes, the man who had been talking to her was hauled away by his wife. Agnes lifted a hand as if she were about to say something in response to him, and found herself talking to a broad expanse of dinner-jacketed back. She turned, her face rigid. "Sorry, I got stuck in the crowds."
"My dress is wrong, isn't it?" she whispered to me. "I have made a huge mistake."
She had seen it. In the sea of the bodies, it looked somehow too bright, less avant-garde than vulgar.
"What am I going to do? It's disaster. I must change."
I tried to calculate whether she could reasonably make it home and back. Even without traffic, she would be gone an hour, and there was always the risk she might not come back.
"No, it's not a disaster, not at all. It's just about..."
I paused. "You know, a dress like that, you have to style it out."
"What?"
"Own it. Hold your head up like you couldn't give a crap." She stared at me. A friend once taught me this, the man I used to work for. He told me to wear my stripy legs with pride.
"You're a what?"
He was telling me it was okay to be different from everyone else. "Agnes, you look about 100 times better than any of the other women here. You're gorgeous, and the dress is striking. So just let it be a giant finger to them, you know? I'll wear what I like." She was watching me intently.
"You think so?"
"Oh, yes." She took a deep breath. "You're right. I will be giant finger." She straightened her shoulders.
"And no men care what dress you wear anyway, yes?"
"Not one." She smiled, giving me a knowing look. "They just care what is underneath."
"That's quite a dress, ma'am,"
said Joshua, appearing at my side. He handed us each a slim glass.
"Champagne. The only yellow drink was chartreuse, and it made me feel kind of queasy just looking at it."
"Thank you." I took a glass. He held out his hand to Agnes.
"Joshua William Ryan III.
You really have to have made up that name." They both turned to look at me. "Nobody outside soap operas can actually be called that," I said, and then realized I had meant to think it rather than say it aloud.
"Okay, well, you can call me Josh," he said equably.
Louisa Clark, I said, then added, the first. His eyes narrowed just a little.
Mrs. Leonard Gopnik, the second, said Agnes.
But then you probably knew that.
I did indeed. You are the talk of the town.
His words could have landed hard, but he said it with warmth. I watched Agnes's shoulders relax a little. Josh, he told us, was there with his aunt, as her husband was travelling and she hadn't wanted to attend alone. He worked for a securities firm, talking to money managers and hedge funds about how best to manage risk. He specialised, he said, in corporate equity and debt.
Oh, I don't have a clue about what any of that means, I said.
Most days I don't either. He was being charming, of course, but suddenly the room felt a little less chilly. He was from Back Bay, Boston, had just moved to what he described as a rabbit hutch apartment in Soho, and had put on 2 kilos since arriving in New York because the restaurants downtown were so good. He said a lot more, but I couldn't tell you what because I couldn't stop staring at him.
And how about you, Miss Louisa Clark the First? What do you do?
Louisa is a friend of mine, just visiting from England.
And how are you finding New York?
I love it, I said. I don't think my head stopped spinning.
And the yellow ball is one of your first social engagements.
Well, Mrs. Leonard Gopnik the Second, you don't do things small. The evening was flying by, eased by a second glass of champagne. At dinner, I was placed between Agnes and a man who failed to give me his name and spoke to me only once, asking my breasts who they knew, then turning his back when it became clear that the answer was not very many people at all. I watched what Agnes drank on Mr. Gopnik's orders, and when I caught him looking at me, I switched her full glass for my near-empty one, feeling relief when his subtle smile signalled approval. Agnes talked too loudly to the man on her right, her laugh a little too high, her gestures brittle and fluttery. I watched the other women at the table, all of them 40 and above, and saw the way they looked at her, their eyes sliding heavily towards each other, as if to confirm some dark opinion expressed in private. It was horrible. Mr. Gopnik could not reach her from his position across the table, but I saw his eyes flickering towards her frequently, even as he smiled and shook hands and appeared, on the surface, to be the most relaxed man on the planet.
Where is she?
I leant in to hear Agnes more clearly.
Leonard's ex-wife. Where is she? You have to find out, Louisa. I can't relax until I know. I can feel her.
Big Purple. I'll check the place settings, I said, and excused myself from the table. I stood at the huge printed stand on the entrance to the dining room. There were around 800 closely printed names, and I didn't know if the first Mrs. Gopnik even went by Gopnik anymore. I swore under my breath, just as Josh appeared behind me.
Lost someone?
I lowered my voice. I need to find out where the first Mrs. Gopnik is seated. Would you happen to know if she goes by her old name? Agnes would like to have an idea where she is. He frowned. She's a little stressed, I added.
No idea, I'm afraid. But my aunt might. She knows everyone. Stay right here.
He touched my bare shoulder lightly and strode off into the dining room, while I tried to rearrange my facial expression into that of someone who was scanning the board to confirm the presence of half a dozen close friends, not someone whose skin had just coloured in an unexpected shade of pink. He was back within a minute.
She's still got Nick, he said.
Aunt Nancy thinks she might have seen her over by the auction table. He ran a manicured finger down the list of names.
There, table 144.
I walked past to check, and there's a woman who fits her description. 50-something, dark hair,
shooting poison darts from a Chanel evening bag.
They put her about as far away from Agnes as they could.
Oh, thank God, I said. She'll be so relieved.
They can be pretty scary, those New York matrons, he said. I don't blame Agnes for wanting to watch her back. Is English society this cutthroat?
English society? I don't know. I'm not very big on society events, I said.
Me either, to be honest. I'm so worn out after work that most days it's all I can do to pick up a takeout menu.
What is it you do, Louisa?
I glanced abruptly at my phone. Oh, gosh, no, I have to get back to Agnes.
Will I see you before you go? Which table are you at?
32, I said, before I could think about all the reasons I shouldn't. Then I'll see you later. I was briefly transfixed by Josh's smile. I meant to say, by the way, you look beautiful.
He leant forward and lowered his voice so that it rumbled a little in my ear. I actually prefer your dress to your friend's.
Did you take a picture yet?
A picture?
Here.
He held up his hand, and before I worked out what he was doing, he had taken a photograph of the two of us, our heads inches apart.
There. Give me your number and I'll send it to you.
You want to send me a picture of you and me together?
Are you sensing my ulterior motive? He grinned. Okay, then. I'll keep it for myself. A memento of the prettiest girl here.
Unless you want to delete it.
There you go. Yours to delete.
He held out his phone. I peered at it, my finger hovering over the button before I withdrew it.
It seems rude to delete someone you've just met, but, thank you, and for the whole covert table surveillance thing. Really kind of you.
My pleasure. We grinned at each other, and before I could say anything more, I ran back to the table. I gave Agnes the good news, at which she let out an audible sigh, then sat and ate a bit of my now cold fish while waiting for my head to stop buzzing. He's not Will, I told myself. His voice was wrong. His eyebrows were wrong. He was American. And yet there was something in his manner. The confidence combined with sharp intelligence. The air that said he could cope with anything you threw at him. A way of looking at you that left me hollowed out. I glanced behind me, remembering I hadn't asked Josh where he was seated.
Louisa?
I glanced to my right. Agnes was looking intently at me.
I need to go to the bathroom.
It took me a minute to recall that this meant I should go too. We walked slowly through the tables to the ladies, me trying not to scan the room for Josh. All eyes were on Agnes as she went, not just because of the vivid colour of her dress, but because she had magnetism, an unconscious way of drawing the eye. She walked with her chin up, her shoulders back, a queen. The moment we got into the ladies, she slumped onto the chaise longue in the corner and gestured to me to give her a cigarette.
My God, this evening! I may die if we don't leave soon.
The attendant, a woman in her 60s, raised an eyebrow at the cigarette, then looked the other way.
Agnes, I'm not sure you can smoke in here.
She was going to do it anyway. Perhaps when you were rich you didn't care about other people's rules. What could they do to her after all? Throw her out? She lit it, inhaled and sighed with relief.
Oh, this dress is so uncomfortable, and the G-string is cutting me like cheese wire, you know?
She wriggled in front of the mirror, hauling up her dress and rummaging underneath it with a manicured hand.
I should have worn no underwear.
But you feel okay, I said. She smiled at me.
I feel okay. Some people have been very nice this evening. This Josh is very nice, and Mr. Peterson on the other side of me is very friendly. It's not so bad. Maybe finally some people are accepting that Leonard has a new wife. They just need time. Hold this, I need to pee-pee.
She handed me the half-smoked cigarette and disappeared into a cubicle. I held it up between two fingers as if it were a sparkler. The cloakroom attendant and I exchanged a look, and she shrugged as if to say,
"What can you do?"
"Oh, my God!" Agnes said from inside the cubicle. "I will need to take whole thing off. It's impossible to pull it up. You will need to help me with zipper afterwards."
"Okay,"
I said. The attendant raised her eyebrows. We both tried not to giggle. Two middle-aged women entered the cloakroom. They looked at my cigarette with disapproval.
"The thing is, Jane, it's like a madness takes hold of them," one said, stopping in front of the mirror to check her hair. I wasn't sure why she needed to. It was so heavily lacquered. I'm not sure a Force 10 hurricane would have dislodged it.
I know. We've seen it a million times. But normally, at least they've got the decency just to handle it discreetly. And that's what's been so disappointing for Catherine. The lack of discretion.
Yes. It would be so much easier for her if it had at least been someone with a little class.
Quite. He's behaved like a cliché. At this, both women's heads swiveled to me.
"Louisa,"
came a muffled voice from inside the cubicle.
"Can you come here?"
I knew then who they were talking about. I knew, just from looking at their faces. There was a short silence.
"You do realize this is a non-smoking venue?" one of the women said pointedly.
Is it? So sorry.
I stubbed it out in the sink, then ran some water over the end.
Can you help me, Louisa? My zipper is stuck.
They knew. They put two and two together, and I saw their faces harden. I walked past them, knocked twice on the cubicle door, and she let me in. Agnes was standing in her bra, the tubular yellow dress stalled around her waist.
What?
She began. I put my fingers to my lips and gestured silently outside. She looked over, as if she could see through the door, and pulled a face. I turned her round. The zipper, two-thirds down, was lodged at her waist. I tried it two, three times, then pulled my phone from my evening bag and turned on the torch, trying to work out what was stopping it.
You can fix this, she whispered.
I'm trying.
You must. I can't go out like this in front of those women.
Agnes stood inches from me in a tiny bra, her pale flesh giving off worn waves of expensive perfume. I tried to maneuver around her, squinting at the zip, but it was impossible. She needed room to take the thing off so I could work on the zip, or I couldn't do it. I looked at her and shrugged. She looked briefly anguished.
I don't think I can do it in here, Agnes. There's no room, and I can't see. I can't go out like this. They will say I am whore.
Her hands flew to her face, despairing. The oppressive silence outside told me the women were waiting on our next move. Nobody was even pretending to go to the loo. We were stuck. I stood back and shook my head, thinking. And then it came to me.
Giant finger, I whispered.
Her eyes widened. I gazed at her steadily and gave a small nod. She frowned, and then her face cleared. I opened the cubicle door and stood back. Agnes took a breath, straightened her spine, then strolled out past the two women, like a backstage supermodel. The top of the dress around her waist, her bra two delicate triangles that barely obscured the pale breasts underneath. She stopped in the middle of the room and leant forward so that I could ease the dress carefully over her head. Then she straightened up, now naked except for her two scraps of lingerie, a study in apparent insouciance. I dared not look at the women's faces, but as I draped the yellow dress over my arm, I heard the dramatic intake of breath, felt the reverberations in the air.
"Well, I," one began.
"Would you like a sewing kit, ma'am?"
The attendant appeared at my side. She worked the little packet open while Agnes sat daintily on the chaise longue, her long, pale legs stretched demurely out to the side. Two more women walked in, and their conversation stopped abruptly at the sight of the nearly naked Agnes. One coughed and they looked studiedly away from her, stumbling over some new conversational platitude. Agnes rested on the chair, apparently blissfully unaware. The attendant handed me a pin, and using its point I caught the tiny scrap of thread that had entangled itself, tugging gently until I had freed it and the zip moved again.
Got it!
Agnes stood, held the attendant's proffered hand and stepped elegantly back into the yellow dress, which the two of us raised around her body. When it was in place, I pulled the zip smoothly up until she was clad, every inch of the dress flush against her skin. She smoothed it down around her endless legs. The attendant proffered a can of hairspray.
Here, she whispered. Allow me.
She leant forward and gave the fastening a quick spray from the can.
That'll help it stay up.
I beamed at her.
Thank you. It's so kind of you, Agnes said.
She pulled out a $50 bill from her evening bag and handed it to the woman. Then she turned to me with a smile.
Louisa, darling, shall we go back to our table?
And with an imperious nod to the two women, Agnes lifted her chin and walked slowly towards the door. There was silence. Then the attendant turned to me and pocketed the money with a wide grin.
Now that, she said, her voice suddenly audible, is class.
Chapter 6. The following morning, George didn't come. Nobody told me. I sat in the hall in my shorts, bleary and gritty-eyed, and at 7:30 grasped that he must have been cancelled. Agnes did not get up until after 9, a fact that had Ilaria tutting disapprovingly at the clock. She had sent me a text asking me to cancel the rest of her day's appointments. Instead, sometime around mid-morning, she said she liked to walk around the reservoir. It was a breezy day, and we walked with scarves pulled up around our chins and our hands thrust into our pockets. All night I had thought about Josh's face. I still felt unbalanced by it. Found myself wondering how many of Will's doppelgangers were walking around in different countries right now. Josh's eyebrows were heavier, his eyes a different colour, and obviously his accent wasn't Will's. But still. "You know what I used to do with my friends when we were hungover," said Agnes, breaking into my thoughts. "We would go to this Japanese place near Gramercy Park, and we would eat the noodles and talk and talk and talk."
"Let's go, then."
"Where?"
"To the noodle place. We can pick up your friends on the way."
She looked briefly hopeful, then kicked the stone.
"I can't now. It's different."
"You don't have to turn up in Gary's car. We could get a taxi. I mean, you could dress down. Just turn up. It would be fine."
"I told you, it's different." She turned to me. "I tried these things, Louisa, for a while, but my friends are curious. They want to know everything about my life now. And then when I tell them the truth, it makes them weird."
"Weird."
"Once we were all the same, you know? Now they say I can never know what their problems are because I am rich. Somehow I am not allowed to have problems. Or they are strange around me, like I am somehow a different person. Like the good things in my life are an insult to theirs. You think I can moan about housekeeper to someone with no house?"
She stopped on the path.
"When I first married Leonard, he gave me money for my own. A wedding present, so that I don't have to ask him for money all the time. And I give my best friend Paula some of this money. I give her $10,000 to clear her debts, to make a fresh start. At first she was so happy. I was happy too, to do this for my friend, so she doesn't have to worry anymore like me."
Her voice grew wistful.
"And then she didn't want to see me anymore. She was different, was always too busy to meet me, and slowly I see she resents me for helping her. She didn't mean to, but when she sees me now, all she can think is that she owes me. She is proud, very proud, and she does not want to live with this feeling. So," she shrugged, "she won't have lunch with me or take my calls. I lost my friend because of money."
"Problems are problems," I said, when it became clear she was expecting me to say something. "Doesn't matter whose they are."
She stepped sideways to avoid a toddler on a scooter. She gazed after it, thinking, then turned to me.
"You have cigarettes?"
I had learnt now. I pulled the packet from my backpack and handed it to her. I wasn't sure I should be encouraging her to smoke, but she was my boss. She inhaled and blew out a long plume of smoke.